but I am not defined by where a book ends up on the New York Times bestseller list or by the sales reports. Like, we are kind of the sum of our relationships. And so no one can take that away if your book doesn't get published or a book doesn't do well.
Hey there, I'm Goli Kalkaran, and this is Lessons from a Quitter, where we believe that it's never too late to start over. No matter how much time or money you've spent getting to where you are, if ultimately you are not happy, then it's time to get out. If you're feeling stuck and you feel like there's got to be more, there's got to be a way to feel fulfilled and excited about what you do, then this is the podcast for you. Each week, I will sit down with an inspiring guest who quit their professional career in order to forge their own path and create a life that they love. Hi, friends. Welcome to another episode of Lessons from a Quitter. I am so excited that you are here. I hope you guys are great. I just kicked off my 12-week group coaching program, Stuck to Strategy, and I am so excited to jump in with this cohort. These people are so inspiring already in what they are doing and all the things that they've done, and I'm so excited to help them get on a path that is more aligned with what they want to be doing. We did a 5-day challenge that led into this, and that was just such a transformative experience, both for the challengers and for me. It was the first time I did that, and I loved doing it. I will likely do it again. If you did not join and you are interested in maybe getting more clarity on finding your path, I do a coaching call that is free once a month, just on Zoom. You can jump on and we can talk about whatever it is that you're struggling with. You can sign up at quitterclub.com/coaching. Okay. Now that that is out of the way, I'm so excited for today's episode with the amazing Emily Giffen. I'm sure you have heard of her, but if you haven't, you're going to want to run out and buy her books. She is a 10-time New York Times best-selling author. That is unbelievable. Her incredibly successful career as an author is something to aspire to, but what I am so excited to talk to her about is her journey of getting there. And like many people who have come on the show, she started out as a lawyer. She went to college at Wake Forest University and then went on to University of Virginia School of Law. And it wasn't until after law school, when she had moved to Manhattan to work in a big law firm to pay back her loans, that she began writing on her spare time and dreamed of becoming a writer. And in 2001, she decided to quit and move to London to pursue her dreams full time. And it was there that she started writing her first breakout hit, Something Borrowed, which is a story of a young woman who, upon turning 30, finally learned to take a risk and follow her heart. A message that is very close to this podcast's message. And her gamble paid off. She landed an agent and signed a book deal, and it went on to become a huge sensation. And it was actually even turned into a movie that starred Kate Hudson and Jennifer Goodwin and John Krasinski. Like, how incredible. But what I'm so excited to have her here for and to talk about, besides the fact that she has a new book called The Lies That Bind that is so good and you should pick up, is just this, you know, idea of taking a risk. Like, we talk a lot about like the luck involved and all these other things falling into place, but if you don't put yourself out there, it'll never happen. And I think so often we all focus so much on what we might lose if we leave. Like, we worry about the sunk cost. We worry about, well, I spent this much on my education and I spent this many years and what'll happen if it all goes to waste and all of that stuff. And we don't look at the opportunities that we are giving up by staying stuck, and we don't look at the possibility. And obviously, I think when Emily started, she couldn't have envisioned that she would have, you know, 10 New York Times bestselling books and this incredibly successful career. But had she not taken that risk, then none of this would have come to pass. And what a shame that would have been. So I will stop rambling so that we can jump in and talk about all of the amazing things that Emily has accomplished. So without further ado, here is Emily Giffen. Hi, Emily. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me. What a pleasure.
The pleasure is all mine. I am so excited to talk about this incredible career that you have. But we typically kind of start back from the beginning. And I know that you are a very accomplished author at this point, but What a lot of people may not know about you is that you used to be a lawyer and you went to law school. So can you tell us a little bit about what led you to law school? And like before you left, did you have a desire to be a writer?
For sure. Yeah. Well, I'm going to go back really far in time and tell you that in the first grade was when I sort of made the proclamation to, it was like one of those classroom things where everyone had to say what they wanted to be when they grew up. I said, write books. And I remember my mother said, oh, the word for that is author. And so I'm like, okay, I want to be an author. And so really consistently throughout my life, I wanted to write. I was a big reader. We moved around a lot. My father worked for Sears and we kind of moved schools every 2 years until we ended up in Chicago. So books were very much my friends. Characters were my friends. And because I was always going to a new school and meeting people. And one of the first things we would always do when we moved is my mother, who's a retired librarian, we would get like our library card. And my sister and I would, you know, these trips to the library were like such a big part of my childhood. So it's more like what, you know, why did I go to law school than like, why did I leave the law to write? But I think that that is such a common theme with attorneys and lawyers. And I think it's because if you knew what you wanted to do, you probably would have gone to medical school. But I think a lot of people who make the decision to take the LSAT and go to law school sort of fall into this general camp. I mean, yes, some of them have this burning passion to be an attorney, but I think a lot of us would fall into the camp of a liberal arts education. Mm-hmm. We did well in school. You know, we want to achieve, but we're not quite sure exactly how to do that and, you know, what we want to achieve or how, like, I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't really know how to go about, like, I couldn't just like sit down and start writing a novel upon graduating from college. So I took the LSAT, went to law school. Never have regretted that decision to go to law school. It kind of brought me to the ultimate decision that I wasn't doing what I loved. And so I think during that time, law school, I loved school in general, but when I started to practice, I'm like, oh, this is bad. Yeah. This is not what I want to be doing.
I think that a lot of lawyers can relate to that. But I'm wondering, like, when you were deciding, because I agree with you that most people that go to law school or even different types of graduate schools, you kind of are coming out of college and you don't really know what to do with that degree. And so you kind of keep going.
It feels safe to stay in school.
Exactly. But I think, like, for a lot of people, it's because they maybe don't have a passion or they don't have something in school where they thought, but for you, it clearly seems that writing was something that you wanted to do or you wanted to be an author. Did you ever consider, like, you know, maybe I can try to make this work and then, I don't know, the fear takes over or you talk yourself out? Or was it like you didn't even think that that was an option?
No, I think that, well, that's a really good question because I think, like, for a while, I considered sports journalism. Oh, like, okay. I was the manager of the college basketball team and I love college basketball. And I kind of thought about going down that road. And so I think that if I had done reporting, like that's very logical, like what you want to go do, you know, you get a job and an entry-level job as a reporter, but to write fiction, it seems like you really need the life experience. I mean, you can sit down and start writing, but that's not going to pay the bills kind of thing. And to your question about fearing it, yes. I mean, I think probably, you know, going after something that you really want is scarier than going after something that you think is like the smart thing to do and society accepts it as sort of, oh, that's a great thing to do to go to law school. So I think there was a safety in, well, I'll pursue this. I know I can be competent about it. I know I can like go to school, study hard and sort of control the outcome and get a job and, you know, go from there. And, you know, I got into it. You know, a good law school. And so it was just, it all felt so much safer than going after something. And I think part of it was to your point, I wasn't sure about those steps. I mean, I guess I could have gone to study, you know, a graduate level in creative writing and, you know, so forth, but I don't know. It just sort of felt like a law school's safe.
Right. Right. And so speaking of that safety though, when you then graduate and you have loans and you get a job at a big law firm that pays you a great salary, and like that is the epitome of safety. And so many people find themselves in that. And, you know, it's like the proverbial golden handcuffs and you're kind of now doing what society tells you to do. So at what point in that process did you start even thinking like, I'm going to walk away from the thing that I now have a degree in and that is safe and go after this risky thing that I'm assuming even at that point you didn't maybe quite know exactly how to go about being an author?
The first day. The very first day when we're learning like the phone system and sitting there at my desk, I'm like, what have I done? I mean, maybe not the first day, but very quickly as I started to do the work. And I think that was part of the problem. When you do well in law school, you sort of, it's like the better you do sort of academically, the more you're at risk to falling into these traps of climbing the next rung to what you think success looks like. So because I did, you know, well in college, I did well in ELSA, it took me to law school. And then once I did well in law school, that opened up the door, particularly with the economy at the time in the mid 90s, like it opened up the door for I could get a job at a large New York City corporate law firm. And so why would you take this other job when you could, you know, you have these law school loans and you could take the one, you know, the big law firm job and make, you know, twice the amount and pay off your loans faster, but you're still making all these, you're sort of still following that same mold of like, if 100 people surveyed, what would they say the smart thing to do now is? So very quickly, I knew that I didn't like what I was doing. But, you know, at that point, as you said, it's the golden handcuffs, particularly when you have loans. It's like, well, I've got to pay these back before I do something else, even if it's just to be a different kind of lawyer or do, you know, different kind of work. Like, I still have to pay these loans back. So I would say in very short order, I developed like a payback my loan plan and like an exit strategy. Maybe like a year in, like maybe I gave it a year. I can't remember, but I think that's being generous. If it was a year, it's probably more like 6 months. And then I said, okay, I need to get out of here. Like this isn't the right fit for me. And there were things that I loved about the experience. I don't know that I could see it as clearly at the time. I think with hindsight, you always see parts of your life with more clarity, but I don't know that I would have lived in New York City without the safety of a job like that. And so, and the, you know, the friendships, like no matter where you are in life, you're going to meet people who are so important to you. And some of my best friends are from that era. And ultimately, I think I was able to write my first novel because of some of those experiences and, you know, that my protagonist character shared my profession and dislike of it. And so, you know, a lot of really good things came from that. But yeah, my plan was pay back the loans and in the meantime, write. So I started writing a novel. Probably my second year practicing, I started to write a novel, like, you know, weekends and nights. And this is probably sometimes when I was supposed to be billing General Electric or Philip Morris, but I, you know, I would write. And it took me about 4 years to finish. And I got an agent, which was so exciting because people, you know, you always hear that getting an agent is half the battle or even more than that. So I'm like, oh, wow, I have an agent. And then she submitted it and I got all of the, you know, rejection letters that came in. Then it was a question of, do I want to take another 5 years to write a book? Because that's kind of how long it takes when you're working these long weeks. And I just decided that I didn't want to waste that much time. I wanted to go for it. I wanted to try to write another one faster. So that's when I quit.
I love that. I mean, I did the same thing when I got into big law and I was like, okay, I'm going to stay here and pay off my loan so that I have some freedom. So I'm not kind of buried under this crushing debt. But I think what a lot of people do is maybe do that kind of a plan and then think, okay, what's maybe I can jump to another type of job that's not as demanding or, you know, and you kind of go from the next safe thing. And I think your case, the story is so interesting because so many people that may try something on the side, and then if it doesn't work, you know, that doubles down their fear. Like, okay, I tried submitting this and I got rejected. Maybe I'm not cut out for this. Maybe this isn't for me. This is too risky. Like all the thoughts come in. And I feel like that we typically end up, even if we had a glimmer of hope of like going after our dream, we kind of put that to the side because we tried and it didn't work. And so I love the fact that like you got rejected. And instead of saying like, okay, I should just stick with the safe thing, you realize like, I'm going to quit and just go all in on this thing.
Yeah. I mean, I guess looking back, that was quite kind of a gamble or a risk. And I remember when I left my law firm, which happened to be like shortly before 9/11, there's so many parallels to the moment we're in now, I think, than with COVID and 9/11. But I remember when I was leaving my law firm, the elevator door, I was waiting for the elevator doors to open. And one of the partners who I worked for, who wasn't one of my favorites, at the firm said to me, oh yeah. And he knew, I mean, I'm sure he knew because I had given notice and I had discussed it, but he goes, oh yeah, you're going to write a book, aren't you? Or something. And I said, yeah, you know, I'm going to try. And he said, yeah, everyone's got a book. Everyone wants to write a book. Oh, and I said, mm-hmm, yeah, you know, I know where you're going with this, Bob. I said, yeah, kind of waiting for the door, jamming the button, like, come on, elevator. And he said, well, good luck with that. And he did the two, you know, the gun finger,
oh, God,
double holster, like, good luck with that. And I'm like, oh God, okay. You know, that was very kind of motivating to me, those sorts of, I have to try again. Like, I don't want this story to end with, oh, I had a lifelong dream of being a writer and this love of books and stories, and I'm going to write one young adult novel, you know, while I'm practicing law and get rejected, and then that's just going to be it. But I also have said, and I believe that there's a gift almost to being in a place that's miserable. Like, I think complacency is a scarier trap than misery. You know, like if you think about it in terms of like relationships and love, like it's the one that relationship that's like not working at all and you're miserable and he's like cheated on you and, or you want to be with someone else, or like there's even darker themes, of course, where you just like, you get out of that relationship. But the ones that are like, oh, this is comfortable, this is good enough, they tend to be the ones that you might stay in because the idea of being alone is so terrifying. And I think the same is true with our work. Like a lot of people stay in jobs that are just okay because it's just easy. So in a way, I think it was like, I don't deserve as much credit as the people who leave comfortable situations rather than like, oh, I cannot stand this job another minute kind
right.
of thing.
Well, I think you deserve all the credit. And I love that I feel we always do this. We always minimize. I was like, oh, mine wasn't as brave. And I agree with you 100%. I think that while it's hard to see, like obviously nobody wants to be miserable, when you are miserable, it pushes you to act. Or when you kind of go to this kind of, not rock bottom, but I'm just saying like when you go on, you're in your place and you're unhappy, you're absolutely right where, you know, there are so many people that are just kind of living in this place that they've just accepted this like lot in life and they might not be happy, but hey, like better the devil you know than the devil you don't. So like you stick with it and you just stay. And so I definitely think it can be a motivating factor when you truly are unhappy. But I still love the idea that, you know, a lot of people can be miserable and then look for the next safe thing, right? Like we see this in law all the time. There's no wonder that a lot of people leave these big law firms because it's really just a very hostile, like, work-life environment. And so people leave and they go in-house or they go work for the government or they go to a smaller firm, even though they don't like law, but it's like, okay, that's the next safe thing. And so I'm wondering when you left, I mean, this partner said something that is frustrating, but like, I'm assuming like, did people that were close to you that loved you, like your parents or family, were they concerned? Because so many times we have well-meaning people that we really do value their opinion and they're doing it out of honestly love and caring and they want you to be safe. But a lot of time that also affects people and staying because people question like, you're going to leave this secure job. Maybe can you just get another one that's not as many hours?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I was 29 and I think that that also worked to my advantage. I think, you know, when you're older and you have more responsibilities, like I wasn't married, I didn't have children. I think it's even harder to do that because you're looking out for other people. But for me, you know, it's just me. And so that was sort of easier. And also I viewed it at the time, maybe naively, but as like, okay, I can go back to, I remember saying to my father, who's definitely like more, you know, oh, he was much more nervous about me leaving this job than say my mother, who was retired librarian, great love of books. Like, oh, this is a dream. Like you can do it. My dad was like, this just makes me really nervous. You know, what if we come into a recession? And I remember saying to him, like, you know, I have this degree. I have this experience. I have these pretty good references. I wasn't the best law associate, but I had some good references. You know, I can go back to this. You can reverse directions. And so for me, it was like a 1 year thing. Like, I know I can write another novel in a year. I worked at odd jobs along the way too, and I had some money saved up and it was doable. But I remember saying to my dad, it's just like 1 year, and a year from now, maybe I'll be back right in the same place, you know, same firm. Maybe I'll be at a different firm, you know. Maybe I'll go back to Chicago where I was from, which would have, you know, would have made my parents happy, you know, if that was what I wanted. So yeah, again, I appreciate what you're saying in general, that we do tend to minimize. I think especially as women, we minimize what we do what we're doing right, and we often focus on what we're doing wrong. And so I have tried to embrace the fact that it was pretty brave.
Yeah.
You know, it was. And 29, of course, seems so young to me now, but at the time, you know, it was more of like, oh, I'm about to be 30. What am I doing? Which is just comical at this point at 48, like not how I see things. So yeah. And one of the things I've said to my kids, I have three children who are all teenagers now, but that rejection was a gift in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. that first manuscript rejection, because it made me so much more appreciate when I finished something borrowed and submitted it and got a new agent and got the offer, like you appreciate it more. And it also gave me the perspective that I believe in so wholeheartedly, that it's luck is a huge component of so much of our lives and so much of our, you know, professional success and really personal satisfaction too, but professional success. It's like, it was so much luck involved, down to the timing of the kind of book that I was writing and then what was happening sort of in the publishing industry, because, you know, Devil Wears Prada and Bridget Jones' Diary, they were kind of huge books. And so they were looking for this chick lit genre. And even though my book was sort of about like the darker side of relationships and sort of melancholic at best, you know, the protagonist is having an affair with her best friend's fiance, and it's sort of about a troubled friendship. And the book was supposed to be called Rolling the Dice. But when I finished and, you know, it found its home with St. Martin's Press, my editor said, oh, let's just do a more chick lit title. And so I'm like, really? Like, I don't, you know, but I trusted her because she's the marketing person. So I'm like, okay, let's, how about Something Borrowed? And she was like, oh, that's good. I like that. And then it got the light pink cover and the ring on it. And I guess my point is, if I had written a different kind of book that couldn't have been marketed that way, it might not have ever been published. So the luck part, but this is what I always tell my kids, the hard work creates the lucky breaks.
Absolutely. Like
if I hadn't worked hard again and taken that chance,
yeah,
then there would have been, that doesn't matter. Like luck can't come.
Exactly. And I'm not in any way doubting that certain things fall into place and doors open. But like you just said, I mean, it's not going to come knock on your door. Like you have to take the step out. And I think that it's incredible that the timing all worked out the way that it did for you. But had you not taken the risk of quitting your job and taking a year and writing this book, then none of this would have ever happened. And I think so many of us, because it is unknown and there is luck and maybe it doesn't work out the way that we want it, and maybe it doesn't work out the first time or second or whenever, it's like we stay stuck in that place where we know we're not happy or we know is not for us. And I think it's incredible that you had just the courage to go after it. And so you take a year and you write Something Borrowed. And I think that, yes, like the timing of it is amazing, but honestly, your career has been incredible. I think every one of your books is a New York Times bestselling book. To come out book after book after book and have this type of success is not, I assume, is not very common. I mean, I don't know much about authors and writing, but I know a little bit. And I feel like this is a very incredible career. So it's a testament to not just luck, but your skill as a writer.
That's kind. I mean, but again, I'm not trying to minimize it. I'm just trying to offer a perspective that it was dependent upon that first book doing well and getting that first book published, and things fell into place from there. Now I had to continue to work hard and write a book that, you know, I couldn't be complacent and had to, you know, it's definitely lots of struggles along the way. I mean, the way you described it sounds a lot more than perfect and storybook,
right,
than kind of the journey has been. And there's, you know, of course you have professional disappointments along the way, and those are inevitable, particularly when you're, you know, barely ambitious. But yeah, I mean, definitely I've been lucky and I've continued to work hard. I'm very grateful that I'm doing what I love. But even that, like, how often do we're in the relationship we want, or we're in the profession we want, like we have all of our wish list and dreams coming true, and you're still tend to focus on what you haven't accomplished or what you haven't done. I don't know. I'm fascinated by the human condition. I saw this documentary on, it's called Happiness or something. It has a smiley face on the cover. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that one?
I haven't. I've heard of it, but I haven't watched it.
I think that's the title, just Happiness. But it says that people return to their bait, like you have like this baseline, and you return to your baseline much faster after something like wonderful happens than when something bad happens.
Oh, interesting.
So it's like you win the Super Bowl,
yeah,
right? NFL player, and you win the Super Bowl and you've worked towards this. you think that you're going to just be euphoric and instead you kind of return to that baseline faster than if you had something devastating happen and your career ended and it takes longer to get back to that. So, but I think in a way that's important. You don't rest on your, you know, you keep pushing forward.
Yeah. Well, I actually love that you bring that up. And I would love to kind of go down that road with you for a minute, because what I love about the human brain, there's the thing, I think it's called like the hedonic treadmill, which means that we constantly go back to kind of our baseline. And it's interesting that you go back faster from a place of like happiness than you do from a place of sadness. But it's still an amazing thing because it allows us, when there is sadness or when there is failure, you know, not live in that, to kind of get back to where we are. But I think it's really important, and I would love your take on it, because so often we've created this idea that once we get there, it'll be so much better than it is here. Like once I get this job or this career or whatever, then all of my worries will be gone. And obviously, I think intellectually we understand that that's not true, and you have stress and fear and all this stuff all the time. And yet, like, we are constantly striving. And I think for me in that journey is really learning, you know, as cheesy as it sounds, to like, you know, it's the journey, not the destination, and kind of enjoying the process. But I wonder what it's been like for you. And I think a lot of times people then ask me, well, then what's the point of me striving for other goals or to like go do the thing I love if it's not better there than it is here? And I think it is better in certain ways. It just isn't going to be, you know, this like euphoria all the time where you have no stress and, you know, nothing else.
Right.
So I wonder what your experience kind of has been when you have, you know, on paper, this career that most authors would, you know, die for, that would love, like that's what they're striving for. And yet, like, I'm sure that the reality of it is, what's the stresses of everyday life? And then maybe the pressure of writing the next book, and the next one has to be just as good and all this other stuff. So how you kind of deal with that?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it, you know, what do they say? They say that you need like a purpose and a goal to be happy, like just to have reached your final goal and be finished, like that. Those people aren't happy unless they're working towards something. So whether it's like writing the next book or working on a new project or trying to be better at your, you know, your sport or your, you know, whatever it is you're doing, your art, your sport. And so I think that part of that is a good thing to net, to always, you know, to constantly sort of redefine your current goal and what you're working on and push forward to achieve something new. I think the trick though is to balance that with, and again, this probably sounds cheesy too, but with this sense of like gratitude. So you have to sort of force yourself to stop and pause and take stock of things. And by taking stock of things, I mean what's working and then what isn't. What do we want for our lives? What really matters to us? Are we focusing on the right things? Like, are we with the right person? Are we in the right job? Are we, you know, here's one example. I published my first book in 2004. That was Something Borrowed. And then 2005, my second one came out. 2006, my third one came out. 2007, my fourth one came out. And in that same time period, my twin sons were born New Year's Eve 2003. So they were 6 months when I went on my first tour. And then 3 years later, I had my daughter. So now she was just born with when my fourth book came out. And of course, I have like 3.5-year-olds at the same time. So it was so frenetic and so much. And, you know, I would go on tour over the summer. And so the summer is sort of like this idyllic childhood time. I mean, even though they were babies, it's like you picture sort of having these moments, at least being in town, right? At least like putting the little sun hats on them and sun lotioning, you know, putting the sunscreen on and like going to the pool or all of those sorts of moments. Like they just weren't happening. It was just too crazy. And so that was a time when I sort of paused and said, this isn't working for me. And I changed at that point to publish every other year. And so since then it's been 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20. Like, so it's, I went from every once a year, which is what most commercial authors do, to every other year. And I still kind of work full time because I think I'm fairly slow as a writer for a commercial writer, but now it's like a 40-hour-a-week job and not like the 70-hour-a-week. Cause that was just like being a lawyer in terms of, in a lot of ways, like the same sort of pressure. And like, I would wake up in a panic about my deadline and be paralyzed with fear. So you have to sort of be able to pause and ask yourself these questions and couple that with, okay, what do I love about my life and what is working and what am I grateful for?
Absolutely. I love that it's just a constant reevaluation, and it doesn't mean like, even if you're doing what you love, again, I think our culture sort of perpetuates this like hustle of constantly going. And a lot of times, even when it is something you love, it's about kind of taking a step back and asking like, to what end?
Kind of where we are now, don't you think?
100%. I think right now a lot of people are forced in slowing down, and that could be a very big blessing to really get curious about noticing your reaction to that, because so many people have such a hard time slowing down that like this is an interesting experiment to see like, why am I so resistant to not go, go, go and just stopping?
But then there are some people who are like, wow, I really like working from home.
Yeah.
You know, this is, I'm spending more time with my children or so forth. So it's just a time where you are evaluating those things. And the crazy thing is the book that I just wrote, That Lies That Bind, is about the aftermath of 9/11. And then the book is, you know, I finished, I turned it in, I give it to my editor and it's published. And now we're in this like COVID time. So there's so many parallels. I've always been just so interested in that, which is why I chose to set the book in that, The Lies That Bind, in that like aftermath, because I do think it's so interesting that like philosophical side of these historic moments and tragedies, and of course all the protests that are happening right now, and the power of all these events to cause us to sort of pause and reflect and consider what we want.
Absolutely. And what a perfect time for that to come out. And it just recently came out. So I mean, everybody, I will put the links to all of your books in the show notes, but everybody should go out. I mean, it's already a New York Times bestseller. So definitely go out and get that. But do you find yourself, because I know a lot of people in creative fields, I don't know if you want to call it writer's block or have a problem, you know, it seems that when you're on a schedule and it's like, I'm going to publish every year, or every other year, do you find yourself like maybe not coming up with the story or not having the thing to write?
Yes, for sure. I mean, all of that and more. And I do call it writer's block because it just seems like the easiest way to describe it. Although sometimes it's more like sit down at your computer block,
right?
You know, like you can't exactly start writing a book if you're like cleaning out a closet or watching Netflix or otherwise dodging the kind of the fear of sitting down and starting something new. So because I just did publish The Lies That Bind, and I would be on a book tour, but I'm not now, but that's why I love having this conversation. It's sort of some semblance of a book tour, talking to you and talking to other people along the way, even if it's from Zoom. It's the fear of starting. It's always that fear that you go back from the very beginning of deciding to quit the law firm job and start again. I mean, when you're starting something new, you always sort of, there's a part of you that's like, will I be able to do this again? My goal is sort of to always write a book that someone considers their new favorite. You know, it's like people are always going to like, you know, some people are going to like one book better than another book, but like, I feel like I won't be doing my job and won't be, if there's not like someone out there who's like, this is my new favorite. And the idea of letting readers down, because I have such a relationship with my readers, like they matter to me so much. And I kind of write for them now, which is different than when you write before you're published. I just never want to let them down. So all of that can lead to that paralysis of, I can't do it again. I can't do it again. But of course you can.
Yeah. And I love that you bring that up again, like going back to this thing of, you know, it's just a different set of problems. And I think so often we think like, oh, this is the hardest part. Like this is just the worst, you know, getting that first book is the hardest, but then it's just a new set of problems, you know, and it's a matter of being able to manage your own mind around that stuff, like being able to manage that fear and understanding like the, you know, whether it's imposter syndrome or whatever, like it's not.
Oh, yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah. And it doesn't just go away. It just sort of morphs into something different, right? And like now it's like, oh, well, now there's the pressure that you're a New York Times bestselling author. The next one has to be good. It just becomes a different pressure. And I think once you can learn how to manage it, then you can manage it in different settings as opposed to thinking like, once I get to there, then I won't have it.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. And I think, again, it's that constantly checking yourself and saying, okay, what is great about where I am right now? I mean, you know, I have 10 books out. So even though it's harder each time, like I have 10 stories in the world, you know, with different people relating to all 10 of those books in different ways. And so it's like, you really have to, and it's hard sometimes when you're in the moment and you're stuck and you're disappointed or you're upset or something's not going well in your personal life. It's really hard to reset and focus on those things. But I think it's so important, no matter how old we are or what we're doing or whether we're in a job we love or a job we don't love, or I think it's just a really important exercise. And people said that forever. I remember Oprah Winfrey was doing the gratitude, things you're grateful for. And I kind of didn't get it. It was sort of like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, of course you're grateful for some things. But once I really started to actively do that, write that down, think about that, like it does make a huge difference.
I agree. My gratitude practice definitely changed my life. It's just a matter of like what you're focusing on, because every day a million things go right, but we tend to just focus on the things that go wrong. And so when you start shifting that focus, then you start seeing it more often. You start seeing, like, you're training your brain to look at all of the positive. And I mean, who doesn't want to just feel better? So when you're looking at positive things, you tend to feel happier. And I couldn't agree more. I think it's the most simple, like,
it's
practice.
So simple, right?
5 minutes, and it changes your whole life.
For sure. Do you write it down or do you just think of it? Or
I started writing it down. I had originally for like a year, I did it every night before I went to bed. And then it's become more automatic, like what I focus on. And then now we've started doing it with my son, who's 6, at dinner. So we'll just say like 3 things that we were grateful for or happy about that happened that day. And so I'm trying to get him into the same thing, because he tends to like to complain and look at the negative. And he's just in general, like, not, I mean, most 6-year-olds, I think, like, the whining, but he just, I think, is constantly looking at what's not fair and like that didn't happen.
He's just, I think we're wired that way
too.
Totally. I mean, he just might be a more anxious child. You know, that's funny because we've been doing that at dinner time.
Oh, great.
Coronavirus, the same thing. And, you know, my daughter's saying, well, we weren't ever really, it was always like, someone needs to walk the dog. Someone needs to go walk the dog. Like, oh, everyone's too busy. And now we're like going on these like long walks with the dogs with 2 or 3 people in the family. We'll go, like, who wants to go? Oh, I'll go. I'll go. It just seems so insignificant. But when she said that, I'm like, oh yeah, that'll be incorporated into her childhood memories. And hopefully she'll think of like all the walks we went on with the dogs rather than like the time when she couldn't see her friends.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think right now, especially in times when it's difficult, I think often, like, it doesn't mean that you're not acknowledging that it's hard or that there are moments, and like having negative emotions is normal and that's fine to be sad or anxious or depressed or whatever about anything. But I think especially in difficult times, it's so vital to look at, you know, whether you want to call it the silver linings or just things that you're still grateful for, things that so many of us, you know, now we think like, wow, I never really appreciated being able to just go have lunch with my friend or, you know, go out for a cup of coffee. And that makes you appreciate that so much more. And there's something really beautiful in that.
For sure. Yeah, I think you're so right.
I know actually a lot of people in my audience who I've spoken to have aspirations of being writers. And so do you have advice for somebody that, you know, wants to take a chance or try this? Like, how do, you know, is it the way that you did it, where it's you write the book out and you try to find an agent, or like, what is the process? Is there any guidance that you can give to young writers who want to give this a shot?
One thing I think with writing, so many writers, and I did the same thing, say like, you know, I'm an aspiring writer. And I think if you're writing, you're a writer. And so you sort of have to think of it in terms of like, you're already a writer and you're not going to let agent and a publisher who are just like two people with subjective individual tastes. And, you know, you could write the most fabulous book and the editor that the agent submitted it to could have just bought a book very similar to that, right? And so then you're going to get a rejection letter because she doesn't want to buy a second book like it, you know, and it's often not given to someone else in the publishing house. And so there's all these sort of factors outside of your control that would make you call yourself like aspiring. And instead, if you think of yourself as a writer now, you're doing what you love, you're writing. So I think that's an important kind of mindset adjustment. I don't know how much, I mean, I'm sure it applies to all professions, but, you know, I've often thought about it in terms of how many people will say to me in a book signing, like, you know, I want to be a writer. And I'm like, well, you know, if you're writing now, you're a writer. So I think that's important. And then it's the same thing, like just to believe in yourself and be able to visualize what it looks like to reach your goal and to realize that if you don't reach your goal right away, and like nobody really does, I mean, it's just kind of unheard of to just have it be easy. But if you don't, like, you have to also remind yourself about what we talked about earlier about the luck component. The chips didn't fall into place for you. So you have to kind of keep going after it and really try to remember too, if you're writing, it's because you love writing and continue to like make it a joyful practice and exercise, because you're much more likely to be excited about returning to that computer screen or page in your notebook if you like what you're doing. So if you view it too much as this goal that you're trying to reach, then instead of the joy of what you're doing, I think that can also stymie us and sort of change our outlook towards it and make it just less fun. You know, I think professional athletes talk about that a lot, about how they lost their love of the game.
Yeah.
And they had to sort of get that back before they could reach their goal.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, you're speaking my language. I think on this podcast, I mean, as you can see in this conversation too, like the vast majority of what we focus on is mindset stuff, because I think so often we think it's like the tactics, like I have to figure out like how to get an agent, or I have to figure out, and the reality of what stops you is all of these beliefs of I'm not good enough, or like I'm an aspiring writer, I'm not actually a writer yet, or this is too hard, or I didn't get there, so I should just stop. And it's if you can refocus the thoughts on, you know, if this is what I love and I'm going to be committed to doing this, well, then I'm going to find a way to do it. And then we'll see what happens and I will figure it out. And I think understanding that frustration in anything is part of the process. And
but also telling yourself, why wouldn't it be you?
Right.
I mean, it's going to be someone. Like,
I love
why
that.
Why isn't it going to be you? And I think there's a mental block around, there's something about a book, like people who love books and read books. It's like, and you look at this book and it's like finished and it's like bound and, you know, it's typeset and it's got this cover and author photo. And it just seems like so impossible to believe that your story could be that. But there's such a thin line between it being on your computer and it being that on the, you know, shipping from an independent bookstore or from Amazon or on, you know, in the right there in Barnes and Noble and you pick it up. And so I think that's important too. Like it's sometimes use the analogy of a marathon. Like you think of like your friends who have run marathons, and it's so interesting because there's always some like really sporty ones in there that are, you know, run marathons all the time and they're amazing. And, but often like probably 2/3 of your friends who have completed a marathon are not who you would necessarily expect to finish it. They're not like the most athletic of your friends, but they decided that they were going to do it and they made a training program and they approached it like 1 week at a time. And, you know, there's, I mean, I've never run a marathon, but you know, you have like week one, all right, I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
You're not thinking about running 26.2.
Right.
Is it 26.2?
Yes.
Or 26. Yeah. You're not thinking about like, you can't, if you're viewing it that way, it's like when who would start it?
So yeah.
Viewing it that way is like 26.2 miles is like looking at the finished book and being like, oh, this is never going to happen. Instead of just writing one chapter at a time, you know, one page at a time and approaching it that way. So I don't know if that's...
No, that's very like helpful.
Concrete advice, but...
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. It's one step at a time. I love that. And I mean, look where it could get you. I mean, I love talking to... The reason I do this podcast is honestly to show that like, you had every reason, just like everybody else, to be scared and stay at that job and understand that law was the safe path and it would have been a good paycheck and it would have been, you know, you could have made a, I'm not saying you could have made a happy life, but think of every experience and everything that you've been able to experience and go through was literally on the back of just taking that chance and knowing that
for
you
sure,
could,
yeah.
you know, figure it out as you go along. And it's such an incredible thing to see. So thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Of course. And thank you for having me. It's incredible that your podcast is so wonderful for that reason, because I think people just need to hear these stories and be reminded of them and just ask yourself, like, why wouldn't it be you? Why shouldn't it be you?
Yes.
It can be you. And I think what you're doing is like, it's just really inspirational.
Oh, thank you so much. That's so kind of you to say.
Well, thank you.
So Emily, where can people come follow along? Like, where's the best place for them to find you?
I like Instagram the best. It's at Emily Giffen Author. That's kind of my favorite because I like photography so much. And it feels like a little bit of a happier spot to land than some Twitter can be pretty like mean-spirited and harsh.
Totally.
So I spend less time on Twitter for that reason. Or I get a lot of news from Twitter, but I don't do as much posting there. So yeah, come see me. Come tell me your stories. And I post a lot about like my children and my dogs and stuff like that too, because you know, being a writer, as important as it is to me and sharing my stories with you, with my readers, is it's just one part.
Right.
You know, it's one part of my life. That's something else I try to remind myself. Like, it keeps things in perspective. Like, I love what I do, but I am not defined by where a book ends up on the New York Times bestseller list or by the sales reports. Like, we are kind of the sum of our relationships.
Yes.
And so no one can take that away if your book doesn't get published or a book doesn't do well or people, give you a bad review.
Yeah.
You know, I'm still Edward, George, and Harriet's mother. And
right.
My husband's wife and so forth. But so yeah, I like to share a lot of my life and I'd like to always try to keep it real too. There's yeah. like some messy things, like when the kitchen floods, I'll put that on Instagram.
I think that's a great reminder though, too, especially in, you know, the moment right now that we're in and seeing on social media and so many people are like worried about posting something because of their brand. It's so nice to see where it's like, we are full humans with, you know, interests in a myriad of things. And it's not like all you do is write and that's it. And so to see, you know, your activism and involvement in your local community and the things that are important to you, I think it's very important not only to get to know you better, but as an example that like you're not just one thing.
Well, I try to do that. So,
well, I love it.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
I will put that in the show notes as well as your website where, you know, you guys can find all of her books at emilygiffen.com.
Sure, yeah. Well,
thank you so much.
Thank you so much. So much fun talking to you.
This was wonderful.
I appreciate it.
I loved talking to Emily. These are my three takeaways. One, yes, there is luck. But you can't ever get lucky if you don't put yourself out there. Two, gratitude is everything. There will always be a new set of problems. Being able to find the joy in that journey is the key to happiness in your life. And three, don't try to run the whole marathon on day one. You have to take it one step at a time, 1 mile at a time, and you will be surprised by how much you can accomplish. I hope you guys liked this episode. If you did, reach out and let Emily know, and I will see you next week for another one. Thank you so much for listening. I can't tell you how much it means to me. If you liked the podcast, please rate and review us on iTunes. It'll help other people find the show. If you want to connect or reach out, follow along on Instagram and Facebook at Lessons from a Quitter and on Twitter at Quitter Podcast. I would love to hear from you guys, and I'll see you on the next episode.